from sea to shining sea throughout the solar system and extending to interstellar regions beyond. This is the Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on the Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, the Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful, beautiful planet we call Earth, thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. It's the show where you matter. And because you matter, we publish something every week called the K-Files. It's our free weekly newsletter, and if you haven't subscribed, be sure you get over to my website and do so. The website is kevinsmithshow.com, and you'll see where it says K-Files, and you can subscribe in 10 seconds or less. I mean, it's really, really that quick. And you can unsubscribe any time you want to. Now, we have kind of a special guest with us in the studio this evening, and those of you watching on our TV channel can now see my guest in the studio. This is John Lane, and John is one of our listeners, happens to live here in the same area where the studio is, and wanted to come by and watch the show being done live. So he's with us. John, welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I thought I'd come by and see how it's done behind the scenes. I've been listening to the show for probably over a year now and been a fan for at least that long. I think you converted me to the very first show I watched. So it's very interesting to be here and hear it done in person.
Well, thank you. John, how'd you find out about the Kevin Smith Show to start out with?
I was surfing through the internet and found a site called Disclose TV, and your episodes happened to air there. And after I watched everything that I could find on Disclose, I was still hungry for more, and so found your site and have been watching ever since.
All right. What do you do for a living?
I'm in finance. I help people make money and cover those important events in life, such as, you know, deaths and graduations and college funds and retirement, that kind of thing.
Must be interesting times to be in that business.
It's been some major ups and downs over the last little while, yes.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for being a regular listener to the show, and I thank you for dropping in this evening to see the show being done live, and I hope you enjoy it. I hope you're not bored with what you see here.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'm sure I won't be.
All right. Folks, let me urge you, if you are not yet a member of the Kevin Smith Show, you really ought to join. I mean, come on. It's 23 cents a day, right? Now, you drank more than 23 cents worth of coffee today. And if you don't drink coffee and you had your Diet Pepsi, you paid more than 23 cents for that. You know, you just give up two or three cups of coffee in a month, or two or three of those soft drinks in a month, and you've more than paid for your membership at the Kevin Smith Show. 23 cents a day, $6.95 a month. You can't beat it. You really can't beat it. Take 23 cents down to the local store. Tell them you got 23 cents and you want everything in the store you can get for 23 cents. See what you get to walk out with. Nothing. but you get a lot for your 23 cents here. We're going to be talking with Marshall Masters and Richard Shaw right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We've asked John to move around here behind the broadcast desk with me so he can watch all of this stuff. So you can see him back there. And don't let that bother you. He's supposed to be there, okay? So nobody's sneaking up on me. All right. My guest this evening, two guests. One of them, Marshall Masters. The other one, Richard Shaw. And Marshall Masters is known the world over as a future thinker. To be sure, what he thinks about the future is considered by some people to be controversial. Some people think that he's right on target, and other people think he's way off target. And they disagree with what he's got to say. Now, in keeping with our policy on this show, we don't talk about the people that are making waves. We talk to the people that are making waves. And we hear what they've got to say. And we hear it from them, not what somebody else says about them or says they are saying. We hear it from them. And I'm delighted to welcome Marshall back to the Kevin Smith Show this evening. Marshall, welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be back, Kevin.
Now, along with Marshall this evening, we have Richard Shaw of Penlight Productions. Penlight Productions is producing something called Torah Code 2012. Richard, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thank you. It's a really appreciate being on.
Outstanding. Well, folks, I told you Marshall is, and you know this, if you listen to the Kevin Smith Show, you already know this, Marshall and what he talks about in some circles is considered to be controversial. What he's going to be talking about here tonight, I think, will also fit that category. And I talked with Marshall on the telephone, and he shared with me some information that for some people will be interesting. Some people it'll be disturbing. Some people will say, I don't buy it. And all of those responses are entirely okay. But we want you to hear it from Marshall and from Richard. We want you to hear from, well, if both of you gentlemen will pardon my use of the phrase, we want you to hear it from the horse's mouth instead of second or third hand. So, Marshall, why don't you take the lead and sort of introduce to us what you want to talk to us about.
Okay, well, you can just call me Seabiscuit.
Okay, Seabiscuit.
what we want to do is we've posted an article on our site at yowza.com, and we are trying to alert people to what we believe to be is a very troubling convergence of prophecies about a major quake hitting Los Angeles sometime this year, where Richard is going to be talking about the Torah codes that we're finding on it. And Torah code, for your listeners, is, if they're familiar with the term Bible code, Torah code is next generation. You're talking about a whole new capability to really go in and actually vet these things statistically. And so they're much more accurate than Drosnin could have possibly done. And then also we've had some sensitives that have been reporting their munitions of an imminent event in Southern California. And so when we get these connections together, then that's when we feel that we go and we publish it and we announce it. It's really difficult. You get, like, for example, if you get one person that says, I think it's going to happen, well, you got an opinion. But if you have two or three different sources that are coming in completely unrelated to each other, no connection whatsoever, and they're talking about the same thing, that's when you look at that convergence and you go, okay, what are you going to do about it? Is it something that rises to what we would call a threshold where it's actionable? You know, most people are always looking for a smoking gun. They want an aha, they want to see someone come on TV and tell them whatever. But really, you know, if anyone has any experience with military and intelligence aspects, you very seldom have a smoking gun. And when you do, there's a smoking body. But the rest of the time, you're dealing with information that your view is actionable. That there's enough of it, and it's following enough of a pattern that you say, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. You got to do something here. And what we're really saying to people here is that this, we're not calling, you know, this is not a call to panic. Pick up stakes, move out of Dodge, and what have you. No, we're not saying that. All we're saying is that, look, this is the time for you to seriously reevaluate your emergency plans. And we're also saying that 3 days for a major quake event is not enough, that you should really be preparing yourselves if you're down in the Los Angeles area or within 100 miles of downtown Los Angeles, that you want to have a 30-day supply of food, water, and medicines for every person in the family. And of course, you don't have to get nuts with this. I mean, this is just something as simple as, okay, fine. You go to Costco or whatever price club, you get yourself, you know, 50, 100 pounds of pinto beans, and you get some rice and whatnot, eat a lot of bottled water. You go off to some wholesale grocery discount place and you can buy, you know, those large cans of industrial grade peanut butter. You know, pinto beans and peanut butter keep you going pretty well. You get enough of it that you can survive for 30 days, and you have that along with some other basic survival things. And
I guess we could call that sea biscuit cuisine, right?
Sea biscuit cuisine, that's right.
Yeah. Pinto beans, rice, and peanut butter. Okay.
So that's what we're really talking about, and you know, I can discuss it from a standpoint of when you have sensitives, and these are people that are, they have physical symptoms that are associated. It's not sensitives that are having a, you know, they're having a dream or a premonition. We do get quite a bit of folks that report those to us. But with sensitives, what we find more interesting is that they will have specific body complaints that will associate with this, and they learn over time what these different things feel. If they have this kind of body physical effect, they understand what's happening there. If they have this other kind of physical effect, they also learn how to recognize the onset, how to interpret that, and how to move on from it. So this is a learned trait, and consequently they can, I think that we find with sensitives, and the ones that have been publishing particularly for some time, is that they're not perfect, but they tend to be right more often than USGS geologists. And then the other part of it is the new TORA codes, and on this, it really, all of this was really triggered by a sensitive's report, and particularly for the Ventura, California area within the next 2 to 4 weeks. And
all right, well, let me ask you. Look, you know, this is not your first time on the show, and not only have you been on the show several times, you've listened to it, so you know the audience is pretty varied. Some people. Mm-hmm. Are when you talk about sensitives and getting these premonitions or precognitions, they're totally down with that. It's, and there are other people that say, you know, premonitions are nothing. So what level of confidence do you place in these sensitives, and why?
Well, I place the confidence in this in that there's a convergence of things. And I generally, you know, to publish an article, come on the air and talk about telling people to prepare for a major event, understanding that there are no absolutes, is, you know, it's a risky thing for me to do. But it's also one where it's compelling enough, and I think that when I'm looking at sensitives, then I look at the Torah codes, which Richard's going to be talking about, and then I look at what's currently happening. And at the south end of the San Andrea, it's just swarming, and there's a lot of movement going on. So if you, for those that can bring up, I usually use Google Earth, and you can get a plug-in for the USGS, and you can go down there and just spin up the globe and see what's happening. I find it very interesting right now that there's a lot of quake swarm activity on our side of the Pacific, and yet it's incredibly quiet on the other side of the Pacific.
Well, now they did. They did have a fairly major earthquake today, a big one, fairly big, in the ocean, off of the coast of Japan. I believe it was southeast of Japan, southwest of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had one in Southern California today, Baja, and I think it was something like a 4.5 or something like that.
Right. That's correct.
And by the way, we had one in Arizona over on the east side of the state. If people take a look at a map of Arizona, and if you can, some maps may have Mesa, Arizona showing. And if you draw a line due east of Mesa, Arizona to the state line, and then drop just below that line, just barely below that line, right over next to the border of the state, that's where it happened. But it was small. I think it was about a 3 or something like that.
Well, it was actually, but there were two of them
in Arizona.
Yeah, I mean, in that area you're talking about Mesa, all right. You had to the these were out near the border, near New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. I only knew about one.
There was a 3.1 and a 3.5.
Well, I knew about the 3.1.
In that area.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon?
I only knew about the 3.1.
Yeah, yeah. So there were two of them. It's kind of, they're just out there all by themselves, all out on their lonesome. But it's the point that really is troubling for me is, you know, you get down to the border between Mexico and California, and you're talking about an area that is to the west of Mexicali,
mm-hmm.
the border.
Right.
And it is just, it is so thick that it is literally just painted almost solid. So we're seeing this. Richard is telling me that there's been a lot of small shakers down in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived through the Loma Prieta earthquake. And I can tell you that before that hit, all right, we were having a lot of small shakers in San Francisco. And then that big one, boom, it hit. So we're looking at all this. Am I saying absolutely you can take it to the bank that there's going to be a major event? No. What mm-hmm. I'm saying is that we are seeing a convergence, and it's one that really is, it urges caution. It urges caution.
So you're not trying to scare anybody here?
No. What we are saying is that this is a time to be prudent.
Mm-hmm.
It is time to be wise about what you're doing and to look around. You know, it's, and there's another aspect to this thing, is that when you're talking about catastrophes, all right, these things, if you're saying to them, to an audience, well, we're looking at a year, 5 years, a decade off, or something like that, it almost becomes an entertainment issue. It's just like, well, you know, it's almost cinematic experience. But on the other hand, when you're telling people we're seeing something much closer, their first instinct is to slap the snooze alarm because they don't want to hear it. And so as a researcher, it's a real conundrum. I mean, on one hand, there's a convergence and something that I take seriously. And but on the other hand, I know that audiences are going to be slapping the snooze alarm, and so they're going to be more likely than not to go, well, this is nonsense, I'm not going to listen to it. But there will be a few out there that do. It will be beneficial to them. And frankly, in the file analysis, once you have information like this, you come across something like this, you feel the burden of responsibility. What are you going to do with that? If you know that something potentially devastating could happen, do you just say, I'm going to play it safe because there's going to be people on Kevin's show that think I'm a horse's ass and not Seabiscuit? Or do you say, well, I'm going to be responsible for the information?
All right.
If you were in my shoes, what would you do?
Well, I would wait for the Kevin Smith show to call and see if I wanted to be on the air. That's what I would do. I would make sure I got on the Kevin Smith show.
Well, there you go. It's nice to be the king.
All right, we've got about a minute here before we have to go to break. And let me ask this, and perhaps you can answer it in the next minute. What sort of time frame? You said something much closer. What kind of time frame are you looking at?
We're definitely talking about something that would happen by the end of the year, according to the Torah codes, and what the senses are telling us is that it could happen in a few days. So, you know, I would say it's a range of anything. What I would say right now, the prudent thing to do is go to Costco and buy some beans, get some water, get a water filter, get some basic thing, candles, batteries.
Okay, now you're not getting any kind of commission from Costco, are you?
Ah, no. Go to Walmart. you just got to have it set aside. Because keep in mind, if this is a large event, then you're going to have roads breaking up. You're going to have water mains splitting.
Well, right now we have a break taking over, so we'll step away for a few minutes. We'll be back, folks, right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are talking this evening with Marshall Masters. And on the line with us, though we haven't heard him much, but we will, is Richard Shaw as well. And we're talking about the information that has come to Marshall from various sources, sensitives included, that seem to point toward a Marshall, if I mischaracterize this, you correct me, but it seems to point towards a rather major earthquake event. From your point of view, that's the way you see this information. Am I correct?
Yes, good assessment.
Okay. All right. Now, we were talking about the time frame, and you said, you know, it could be in a matter of days, weeks, all the way to sometime before the end of the year. How can you tell? How do you know that time frame?
Well, the time frame is, first off, you have a base time frame, which is your longest time frame, and that's, Richard's going to need to talk about that with the Torah code research he did. And the short term is sensitives that are reporting. The thing about it is that sensitives are not necessarily going to see 6 months into the future. I mean, what they're really responding to, sensitives are their earth changes or something that is building up, and they're sensitive to these forces building up, and that's what they're feeling. So when sensitives are saying that, then something could happen sooner than later, and we're seeing an awful lot of quake swarm activity at the tail end of the San Andrea, which is really not one place you want to see it, because, I mean, to get fault line like that, it just, you know, like a zipper in a jacket, zoom, it just works its way up until it finally gets to a point where it is, you know, it finds a resistance point, and then it doesn't go any further than that.
All right. Now, well, let's hear from Richard. And
I can't say that there would be property damage, perhaps some loss of life. But is it the one that, you know, you go to the movies to see? I can't say that.
All right. Let's hear from Richard about the Torah code. Richard, first let's start with, what is the Torah code?
Well, I got interested in it in the late 90s when the first book came out called The Bible Code, which is actually a misnomer. There's no really proven code in the entire Bible. The code that we're using now to do these searches resides in the Torah exclusively. And
okay, well, I think you should explain to the people, what is the Torah?
The Torah is simply the first five books of the Old Testament in the Bible.
Okay.
And the reason why they're special is because they're all written in the same language, which is the original Hebrew. It's basically a set of books that was given over 3,300 years ago. It was painstakingly transcribed by scribes through the centuries. It's probably the most accurate transcription of any text in human history. And we know from other writings, ancient texts, such as the Midrash and other Jewish texts, that the original Torah had no spaces between the words. So if you held it up and looked at it, it almost looked like computer code. So I got interested in it after reading about the discoverer, Eliyahu Rips, out of Jerusalem, reading Michael Drosnin's book. And on the front cover of his book, when it came out, was a table, a matrix created from running the Torah through a computer, and it said, Yitzhak Rabin, assassin that will assassinate. That table was found the year before Rabin was actually assassinated. So that really caught my attention. So, and a lot of other people too, and the book became a bestseller, and he came out with Bible Code 2. But there were predictions that he made in both books, some that were accurate and some that weren't. A few years ago, I mentioned to a friend of mine that, you know, I'm a filmmaker, so this is something I was just intrigued with and wanted to know more about it and see if we could do an in-depth documentary about it. Even though I'd seen other films about it, I had felt like they had concentrated exclusively on Drosnin's codes instead of going to the source. But at the time, I never could even imagine how I would get connected with a group of rabbis and mathematicians. I just didn't have an idea of how that would happen. And to make a long story short, my friend Lee was on a plane to visit his brother Paul, who is a really great composer. He just wrote the score to Oliver Stone's movie W. Lee went back there to visit him, and he was on JetBlue, and his seat assignment was putting next to this man that looked like a rabbi who was sharing his bread and cheeses with him that he brought on the flight, and they talked for 5 hours. And when they landed in LaGuardia, Lee called me on his cell phone and said, I think this is a guy that you're going to want to talk to. And the first voice I heard was Professor Robert Herelick from the City University of New York. And I learned that, that Robert was tied in with all of the world experts in the Torah Code. They were all his personal friends. In fact, he was the guy who wrote the algorithm to actually search the Torah. So, bingo, we were connected with the whole Torah Code team instantly. It was really kind of crazy.
Okay. Now, explain, you don't have to get very technical, but just explain in a nutshell, how does the Torah Code work?
Well, it's been thought of as for centuries that there was a code in the Torah, clear back to the 12th century and then through later times where Sir Isaac Newton spent 20 years of his life trying to find a code in the Torah. It finally ended up with a rabbi, a mathematician by the name of Michael Weissmandel, who, when he was still a teenager, he's really a brilliant mathematician, and he wrote the entire Torah text down on 3x5 index cards in 10x10 grid as a code breaker might do to look for patterns. And then World War II hit. And so his family was killed in Auschwitz, and he ended up after the war in New York, a broken man, but decided to pick up the whole idea again. And so he did. He got some interns to do the same thing, and they wrote it all down. And he started using code-breaking techniques that he had used to help solve the Enigma code, the famous German code back in World War II. And he stumbled across ELS, which is short for equidistant letter sequencing. It basically means that if I start on a letter and skip every a given set of letters, maybe I'll find something else that's hidden in that text, essentially encoded in the actual Torah text. So he did this in the first five books. He thought, well, let's see what happens. So he started on the first letter T in Genesis, or the letter Tet, and skipped every 50th letter, and it spelled out the word Torah. You know, well, that's interesting, but maybe that's just a coincidence. So then he tried the same thing in the book of Exodus, and counting with his finger, it did the same thing, spelled the word Torah. Well, he went to Leviticus and tried it, and it didn't work. So that, well, maybe that idea is just a freak that it worked in the first two books. Well, the Jewish culture they're very interested in numbers and numerology and the strength of numbers and all of that. So 50 to the Jewish, to the Jews that I've been working with, is a perfect number. And 8 is like a number that ties God and man together. So Weissmandel decided to try the number 8 in the third book, Leviticus, and it spelled out Hashem, which is the Jewish name for God. And then it didn't work in the fourth and fifth books, but it went back to the 50th letter, but it spelled out the word Torah again in Numbers, and in Deuteronomy, every 49th letter, it spelled out Torah. So here's what he ended up with: Torah, Torah, God, Torah, Torah, with the last two books basically a mirror image, so that if you held it up, it would read backwards on the last two books and forwards in the first two books, with God in the center. Now, that's just counting with your finger without using a computer. So 30 years go by, and this brilliant professor, mathematician, Eliyahu Rip, decides to pick up where Weissmandel left off. He worked with a couple other associates named Whitson and Rosenberg, who were computer programmers, and they wrote a program to basically search the Torah text. They took all the spaces out between the words, as the original version was, ran it through, and they started doing looking for things. They had a way where they could put a keyword into the computer and see how many times it would appear in the Torah at any number of skips. The computer would just figure that out automatically. And so they started coming up with really amazing things, and that was in the late 80s. So since then, Jawson's book appears, explaining this to the general public, and now they're using a cluster computer so that they can look at these tables that they're coming up with, because one of the largest opposition factors to the whole Torah code was that, well, you can find codes in any text. I can find the same stuff in Moby Dick or in War and Peace or in any large volume, Hebrew volume of text. So they wanted to make sure people realized that what was coming up in the Torah was different, special. So now they're doing the Monte Carlo experiment. So all professional statistics experts know that the Monte Carlo experiment is basically where you use the control test and you also have maybe 100,000 other checks, and you run the same table and its protocol through all of these other random, what they call monkey texts, to see if you get a similar table. And sometimes you do, but if the probability is like 4 in 100,000 or 29 in 10,000, you still have something that's significant. And that's what they're doing today that Strawson couldn't have done in 1997.
All right. We've got a minute and a half here before we hit the next break. Is the selection of, for instance, every 50th letter or every 8th letter, is the selection of what number to use random?
It's really determined by the computer. The computer looks for a word. You put in an a priori keyword, a word that's chosen in advance. You're not cheating or snooping for words. You say, I want to find North Korea in the Torah. And it'll say, okay, that comes up X number of times in the entire Torah. It searches it end to end, and here are the times it comes up. So one of the rabbis that I've been working with on this, Rabbi Glazerson out of Jerusalem, is a pretty noted author. He's written 25, 26 books. He always picks the smallest skip, the smallest ELS, and the smallest number of appearances that a word appears in the Torah. So like, for example, in one of these LA earthquake codes, there was the year 2010. The year 2010 in Hebrew is 5770.
All right. We have to step away for break. We'll pick up right there when we come back. Don't go away, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guests this evening are Marshall Masters and Richard Shaw, and we were talking with Richard as we went into break, and we had to stop you in mid-sentence, so I want to give you, Richard, the opportunity to finish your thought there.
All right. Well, what I was about to say is that I've been writing some articles for the Examiner about the Torah codes, and we just did a couple of code tables on the Chonin disaster in Korea, and then the last one we did was on the Iceland volcano. We had tables for both of those found by the professors. But I had gotten some people who had written into me saying, what about Drosnin's table on LA earthquake in 2010? Well, I remembered that there was a table in the original Bible code book, so I cracked it open, and sure enough, on pages 141 and 142 in the original Bible code book, it says, Great Earthquake, L.A., California, in 5770, which is the Hebrew year for 2010. But what was interesting to me about that particular table is that it also had the Hebrew year of 5754, which was 1994. And as you remember, that was the year of the Northridge quake, which indeed did happen then. So I thought, well, this table is already half correct. Half of it's already been fulfilled. So do we have an earthquake coming up this year according to the Torah text? So that's when I got a hold of Rabbi Glazerson in Jerusalem. I said, look, we're having questions about an L.A. earthquake, and I think we should look into this. So Glazerson got another one of the Torah team together, Dr. Rotenberg, who made up a new table based on the Drossen keywords, and then they, through Glazerson's very intuitive about this process because of his background and knowledge of ancient texts. He sometimes looks for other interesting words to go along with it. And so they made two new tables based on the Drossen's keywords, and they all came up, and they had ended up with even smaller tables, which are usually considered more significant, with fewer letters in them than Drossen did. So I have one new table that says L.A., California, earthquake in 5770. And in another line it says, this is a threat. So that is a rather ambiguous phrase. We don't know if there's a threat of an earthquake or if there is going to be an earthquake, but that's what it says in the Torah text. What I thought was interesting was that the text for earthquake and the year 5770, actually the phrase in 5770, appeared on the same line, side by side with no spaces between them. That's rather unusual. Also, in 5770 only appears once in the entire Torah, and that's also interesting. So here we have the only appearance of the phrase in 5770 and the word earthquake together on the same line.
Well, I find this phrase, this is a threat, to be most curious, because you may remember that the Secretary of Defense at one time was Mr. Cohen, and Mr. Cohen made the statement, and I'm not quoting, this is my paraphrase of it, but he made the statement publicly that there were rogue states and or terrorist groups that already possessed the ability by electromagnetic waves to create hurricanes and earthquakes, etc. And that's on the public record. That's, I'm not revealing anything that's classified there. That's, he made that statement publicly. Now, what I wonder is, when it says this is a threat, I wonder if what the Torah is the Torah code is saying is that it's not going to be a natural earthquake, but it's going to be threatened by someone with that capability.
Well, I mean, at this point, after studying this stuff for the past 5 years now, nothing would surprise me in that regard. I've learned a little bit about HARP technology. I'm aware of chemtrails and all of those things. There's some people that feel that the reason that we have those is so they can reflect waves back down on the earth. I have no idea. There's no way to prove any of that. I thought what was fascinating was, you remember the Chile earthquake?
Uh-huh.
One of the CNN reporters that I saw on her report called in and said, it was like Apocalypse Now. The sky turned green and yellow during the earthquake. And I'm thinking, well, what in the world would cause that? And that was a CNN reporter looking out her window during the earthquake said, you know, the sky changed colors.
I don't think I've ever heard an earthquake report where they reported that the sky changed colors. I think that has to be a first, at least for me.
Yeah, I've never heard anyone say anything like that. So I'm thinking, well, what could do that unless there was plasma being discharged or something going on in the atmosphere? But I didn't see it, and there was no pictures of it, so there's no way to prove it.
Yeah, there is no way to prove it, but I mean, I think there's, and what you're talking about here, Kevin, dovetails with other things. I mean, I agree with those that are saying that this BP oil well incident was something they didn't see it coming, and there are some people that believe it's the result of an attack. I tend to follow the thinking that this is another example of very subtle earth changes. And it, you know, there was in Minneapolis a few years ago, we had a bridge that just pulled right apart. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And collapsed. People died. You have this, you know, this oil well, and it blows, and it's, I mean, they didn't see this coming, and this was a catastrophic failure. I had absolutely no idea that this was coming. Again, it could be something where there are these subtle changes in environment, there's subtle changes in the earth, and the problem for us is that we're not good at measuring it right now. You know, imagine, I remember when I was a teenager and I used to change, do a tune-up on my car. You know, you used to sit there and kick the engine over so you could get the points set, and you'd have a little feeler gauge and you could get in there and set your points.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these days, you don't need that. You have electronic ignition. But we didn't have a computer we could plug into a car back then. And I'm beginning to see that what we're dealing with here in a lot of different areas where jets are falling out of the sky like they did in the Atlantic in 2008, that is where a pole shift begins. That's where the magnetic shield starts to flip. So there are things that we're just not factoring into the way we build and use technology today because the environment is changing. And, you know, it also is something where, let's say terrorists want to take out the East Coast of the United States. Why bomb the East Coast of the United States? Bomb the western flank of La Cumbre de Vieja. And the flank collapses on that old volcano, and that's it. Takes out the East Coast with a tsunami wave. They don't set foot on American soil. They just send a wall of water our way. Those are the kind of threat environments that we're looking at right now. Still the same. What I think is interesting is that we were, you know, Richard is coming back with more than one table on Los Angeles, and I'd like Richard to really dive into that.
Well, Richard will have to dive into it in a minute and 20 seconds, because then we have a break.
Okay.
That's fine.
Pedal fast.
Oh. Well, if you want me to go into it a bit, I mean, it's basically what I was saying, that there are minimal skips and minimal appearances of these words in these tables, and they basically were based off the original Drosnin table. That's about in the one that says entitled L.A. California, these are available on Marshall's website, by the way. People want to look at these. The abbreviation CLIF, which is California for the Hebrew, it's the third minimal in the whole Torah, and also the best meeting in the whole Torah. When they say the best meeting, it means it's a close meeting against another word.
All right, break took over, and we will be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guests this evening, Marshall Masters and Richard Shaw. And some of you are just now joining us in this second hour. Welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. My sincere sympathy to you for having been put through the ordeal of whatever it was that kept you from the first hour. But we're glad you're here now. And when we went away for break, Richard was telling us about the multiple layers or multiple tables in this Torah code as related to information about the possible earthquake in the Los Angeles area. Richard, I want to give you a chance to finish that thought before we open the phone lines for our audience to join us.
Okay, thanks. What I was just doing was I was mentioning the basically, it's kind of more or less statistical information of how many times these words actually appeared in the Torah and why they used them. But with Clayderson's notes that I have before me here, he said the appearance of the phrase big earthquake is minimal in the whole Torah. The phrase, the year in 5770, which is 2010, is the ninth minimal in the Torah. But the best meeting with the word big earthquake. What's also interesting is that 5770 has an ELF of 9. So it's the ninth minimal and also uses an ELF of 9. So every, you know, 9 letter skip, that word came up. So it's very small. I mean, sometimes you'll run into skips that are hundreds or thousands of letters, and it's not like that in this table.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm assuming that means the smaller the minimal, then the people who have confidence in the Torah code would say that's the smaller the minimal, the higher the probability that this is accurate. Is that right?
Yes, that you could look at it that way. If it comes up that quickly, because we've had other antagonists to this process, the well-known Brendan McKay, statistical expert out of Australia, says he can find the same thing in Moby Dick, and has. The thing is, what we don't know is what his skips were. So if his skips were 10,397 between the letters versus our skip of 6, then, well, yeah, you can make Moby Dick say anything.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have to work that hard at it, and it just comes up, and it ends up in a compact table like many times it does in the Torah, then I just find that, I personally look at that and go, well, how can that be? It just seems more than a coincidence to me.
Kev, can I jump in?
Yeah.
What I'd like to tell everyone is that I've been working on this project with Richard for some time, and the rabbis and the scholars, I mean, these are people that have, they're in research positions in universities, they're very well established in their fields. These, when it comes to taking risks with something that we would call half-baked, they're risk-adverse. And before we could even publish our article on Yowza.com, we actually sought their permission to do that, because, you know, it was important for us to come out and to not feel that, you know, we're cutting loose and making easy with their work. And what they were seeing in the tables impressed them enough that they said, yes, go ahead. And as long as you announce it as it is, what it is, preliminary work right now, but announce it that way, we fully support it. And this is, you know, we're not talking about your typical paranormal authors, you know, sitting in a garage set up somewhere in the house. This is their livelihood. This goes right to the core of what makes their world work. And they're not going to take cheap shots or absurd risks with that. So for them to come forward actually took a lot more guts than I did, and then for Richard as well.
All right.
Just throw you back to Rich.
Well, I'm going to throw you both to the audience. Ladies and gentlemen, the telephone lines are open, and the telephone numbers, for those of you watching on our TV channel, have appeared on your screen. For those of you listening by radio, or computer, or cell phone, or whatever other way, here are the numbers. This number will work from anywhere on planet Earth. 623-444-5889. Now, if you're in the USA or you're in Canada, and if you need to call me on toll-free, you can do so. It is 888-223-4599. If you are not in the USA and you're not in Canada, I don't have a toll-free number for you, but I do have the flash message option. You can go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down. You'll see a link that says Flash Message. Just click that, and you can send me your question or comment that way. However, if you're not in the USA or Canada, we still would love to hear from you, so you can call us at 623-444-5889, and we will be delighted to talk with you. To the telephone, caller, your first name, and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Rex from Miami.
Hello, Rex.
Hey, got a question or a couple questions for Richard. I wanted to make sure I understand the Torah code right. I've read a little bit about it. Does it work like this? If you took like all the letters, let's say from end to end, I don't know how many there are, like 50,000 or whatever, pick a place to start, like say letter 400, skip every something, like say every 6 or 7, and then you put it into a grid, right? Like let's say 10 by 20, and then do a word search style where you go up, down, left, right, diagonal. Is that the way it works?
That kind of basically is the way it works. I mean, there's over 300,000 individual letters in the Torah. Those go into a computer, and the computer finds the first key word that you put in. You pick the word that you want to start the table, and what it does, it makes something called a code cylinder. It does that internally, and that's more or less an imaginary cylinder that you're thinking about. And it takes that key word and lines it up so that it builds a table around that. And so the code cylinder will end up forming a size that best fits those words. That's one thing that Professor Herlich has done, is to write the algorithm to set the size of the code cylinder. And then essentially what you're doing is you're slicing that cylinder open and laying it flat. So what makes it amazing to me is when you have words that line up, after having done all of that, words line up in parallel or on the same line that are associated. That's what has always freaked me out about it.
Okay, Rex, you had another question?
Yeah, and how do you deal with a different language? So it's written in Hebrew, and you're talking about pulling lots of English words and names out of it.
That I leave up to the rabbis mostly, because what they do, they'll look like, if you're trying to find a modern topic, I mean, they even found the name of my company, Pinlight, in the Torah, which really I thought was really pretty incredible. But what they do, they'll look at something in a newspaper and see how that word is spelled today in Hebrew, and then they'll put that word in Hebrew into the computer, and it's all done in Hebrew.
All right. Rex, thanks for the call. Interesting questions. 623-444-5889 is the number to call if you have a question or a comment for our guests here this evening. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin from Beaverton.
Hello, Kevin.
Marshall, I was wondering, what do you think the possibility of learning an event could take place could influence someone to go to the extremes to make it happen or be true?
It's a little weak for me. So,
what do you think about this idea, Marshall? How possible is it that something shows up in the Torah code and someone then goes to extremes to make it come true?
Well, that is an issue of self-fulfilling prophecy. And what I would say is, with other forms of prophecy, you could say that they're trying to do that. And one thing is definitely for sure is that, you know, if you have prophecies, particularly if they're religious prophecies and they're deeply rooted in your belief system, what you now have is a built-in expectation. So somebody doesn't have to sell you a bill of goods. They just find out what you're ready to lay down the plastic for, and they shove it across the counter. And as long as it says, here's your expectation in a box, a lot of people will go for it. And so there's danger in that. You know, not only do you need to be skeptical about everything that you look at in a healthy way and opening a question, but also you need to be skeptical about your own beliefs. You need to be willing, as events and times change with it.
All right. Kevin, thanks for the call. 623-444-5889 or toll-free in the USA and Canada The number is 888-223-4599. If you're outside the USA or you're outside of Canada, if you're in the UK, you're in South Africa, Europe, Asia, Australia, South America, wherever, you can send me a flash message. And just go to my website, scroll down. You will find the link there. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Ryan in Washington.
Hello, Ryan.
Yes, Marshall's a very interesting show tonight. Last time you were on the show, you were able to catch some people that were interfering with the Kevin's show, and I was wondering, would you be able to go into more detail about that? You said that you traced an IP address one time, and I was just wondering if you could tell us more about who are these people that are doing this to Kevin's show, and I'll take it off the air.
Okay, Marshall, but keep it very, very brief. I want to stay on topic as much as possible tonight.
Right. What I would say briefly is how exactly I track them down, I'm not going to tell you. You don't give it away. You find it. What I can say is I worked in the computer industry for many years, particularly with internet technologies. Who's doing it? Most of this disinformation is coming out of London. And that particular show was an easy one. Whoever was hacking Kevin's board was sloppy. These guys usually work from laptops with Wi-Fi so that they're mobile. It's hard to get a fix on them. And this guy left the mic on his laptop. And that's what we picked up, and we nailed him dead on. And so, but I got to give credit to you, Kevin. I mean, it was static hiss and a little bit of scratch, and how you picked up on it so quickly really still amazes me, but it's there.
Well, I'll tell you, and this is quite honest, I think it's from all the years of having to listen to police radios. Most people, if they have to listen to a police radio, cannot understand what the guy says. But
yeah,
I've spent so many years listening to scratchy, bad transmissions on police radios. I guess I just noticed it.
Yeah, well, yeah. We got him red-handed, that's for sure.
Yeah, we did. All right, 623-444-5889 or 888-223-4599. That's the toll-free number here in the United States. What do you think, folks? I think most of you are familiar with the Bible code, and this is essentially that, but it's more accurately named the Torah code because it deals with the first five books in the Bible. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hello, Brent.
Marshall, I'm going to have to correct you for a little bit on the BP thing. They did have about 2 hours of warning where they could have diverted it. Now, on the Torah code, I'm just wondering, have you done a search for Gulf of Mexico?
That's something that we've been essentially looking at North Korea in the code. It's what we've been doing most recently, but I'm sure that there'll be a BP oil spill code coming shortly.
Okay. Thanks.
All right, Brent. Thanks for the call. You know, if we really get specific and if we're really honest about it, almost every disaster that happens to us, there were warning signs and we just didn't pay attention. And of course, people now talk about how all the animals flee an area when there's about to be a big earthquake. But you know, before that big earthquake, what was it, 1999, 2000, something like that? The one off of the coast of Sumatra killed about 250,000 people, the tsunami did. Before that happened, a lot of the animals started leaving the area, and islanders, natives, followed the animals, got out of the way. And a whole bunch of dumb tourists stood out on the beach and said, "Wow, now that's neat. Look at there." And got whacked by the wave.
Yeah. You know, Harry, get a wicker basket. We'll get free fish.
And I don't mean to make light of anyone who died in the tsunami, but I do mean to make light of the fact that we overrate our intelligence very, very often in the West, because we do have a lot of technical knowledge. But you know, when you're in, you're out on a beach, you're in a non-technical situation, you need to look at the animals.
Yep.
And you need to pay attention. I think there are a lot of warning signs. Are you seeing any warning signs in nature? You've got sensitives. Marshall has talked about that. You've got the Torah code. Richard, you've talked about that. What about any warning signs in nature out there that indicate that maybe it's time to prepare for something, for a whole lot of shaking going on?
Well, like we talked about originally, early on in the program, of the USGS reports, I had about 630 earthquakes that I could see on their map for Southern California, Mexicali area, and Northern Baja. So there's a lot of seismic activity going on down there as a result of the 7.2 earthquake that hit last month. It's still settling because of that. But it does seem strange to me that we have earthquakes and volcanic activity all around the Pacific Rim. So I think the thing that intrigued me about the code table about the earthquake was that it was basically thought up in the mid-90s. I don't know when Drazen actually created the table. It had to be done before his book was published. So say he made that table in 1996, no one would have known that in 2010 would be experiencing all these earthquakes now. I mean, I've had, I'm logged on to the USGS Geological Survey, where they send me auto emails of anything above a 6.0 magnitude, and just since the middle of last month, there's been a dozen of them.
Yeah, but what about animals? What about the things in nature that do you know anything about, you know, are the animals beginning to show signs of distress? Are they leaving the area, or do you know?
Let me take that one.
All right.
You know,
Marshall.
Yeah, I mean, I had a good chance to get to know, and on my own show interview, the guy that started Syzygy.org, Berkland. And Berkland, I was in the 1989 Loma Prieta quake, and Berkland actually predicted that quake would happen. Okay, he was right on the money before it happened, and he was working for USGS at the time. They wouldn't pay attention to him. Now, I visited there were two key indicators for him. One, there is a small, like you have in Yosemite with, gosh, it just skips the mind. The water shoots up.
Old Faithful.
Got the term.
Old Faithful geyser.
Well, there's one up in Napa, up in where they make the wine. And that thing, that geyser, began changing its performance and the way it was, you know, its schedule. It was no longer as regular. It became much more active. It was changing color. And as a matter of fact, if you go there now, they actually they have a seismic station right there next to that geyser, you know, maybe only 100 or 150 feet away from it. And they're continually monitoring that plus animals. And so for the folks that are in Los Angeles, start looking for missing cats and dog reports. That's going to be a good indicator, but this is going to be happening something that's as the event is building up within a few days beforehand. And so when the dogs and cats are disappearing for, say, a week beforehand and they're having strange behaviors, you definitely want to be on that and be mindful of that. And the things have changed a lot. You know, for example, Richard's talking about Drazen's code. It was in 1998 for this period, for this quake.
Well, in 1998, think about it, we were using those old clunky analog cell phones back then, remember?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Well, they were not so big and clunky, but analog phones, basic phones, actually I like them better than what we have today. You know, today, I mean, good Lord, I mean, you've got a cell phone that's sort of like a full-bore computer in your hand. They're so powerful. Well, think about it. What Drazen had to work with in terms of technology, think of it in cell phone terms. It was like an old analog phone. These guys are working with stuff that's, you know, he couldn't even dreamed of it. And so they're finding these quotes, but they're finding the tables, which is giving us the long range. Sensitives give us an intermediate range. Animals, all right, and other things are going to give us a shorter range, all right? And I think it's important for people to be mindful of all of this.
All right. But right at this point, you're not aware of any mass exodus of animals.
Not right now, but when there is, that's when you need to be concerned. But, you know, let's be honest. If you're not prepared for a quake, all right, and I'm talking about just lay in 30-day supply of, you know, beans and peanut butter, all right, the old mm-hmm. sea biscuit recipe.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that, by the time this starts to happen and people are aware, then it hits local radio stations, and people are going to get edgy, but after the quake hits, they're not going to be going to the supermarket, all right? You might get there once or twice, but after that, the shelves are going to be bare, absolutely bare. I mean, they had, in hurricanes, they've had stores not only were looted, but people were actually pulling the tile up off the floor. They get insane. They get crazy with that. You don't want that. You know, if you want to be able to just have some supplies set aside, you know, you can hunker down with the family. Worst comes. If it doesn't, so what? You've got $100, $150 worth of beans and peanut butter that you've lost.
Oh, I don't know. You know, it's a fabulous cuisine. You might want to eat it anyway, right? We have to step away for a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Don't go away. Welcome back. We're talking this evening with Marshall Masters and Richard Shaw, and we're talking about information that seems to have coalesced and converged that Marshall says he thinks points to an upcoming major earthquake in California sometime this year. But if I, and again, if I mischaracterize this, Marshall, correct me, but what I understand from what you have said is that because of the fact that, I mean, you've got the Torah code, that's part of the information, but because of the fact that you're getting from several intuitives the same thing, you think it's close term rather than a long term thing.
It could. You know, when sensitives are reporting it, that is an indicator of what I would call a close term. Let's use three definitions of a time frame.
Okay, let me say to the caller, if you will, just hang on. We'll get to you in just a second. Okay, go ahead, Marshall.
Okay, let's think of this as we have three elements in a convergence.
Mm-hmm.
And the first element is your long-range forecast. It sets your. This is the basic scope of when is this going to, if this event is going to happen, when will it likely happen? Torah code establishes that. It just simply says sometime within 2010. And it's very, very strong.
Okay.
Now, the question then is, where are we in relationship to 2010 and the event specifically within 2010? There's a, what I would call an intermediate term. This is going to be your sensitive, human sensitives that are, they're having
physical experiences that go with this. And like I said, they're not, it's not that they're infallible, but they're better than weathermen and geologists, let me put it to you that way.
Okay.
So when they're talking about it, you're looking at something that is, it could be anywhere from a matter of days to about 2 to 4 weeks. That's what we usually allow. Then what we were talking about earlier, where you're observing animals, you're doing what Birkeland was doing when he predicted the Loma Prieta quake. You're looking to see for lost animals and changes in geysers, other things that are going to be directly related. That is going to give you a short-term harbinger signal. And, you know, Birkeland, even though he was absolutely dead on the money in predicting it, the USGS just brutally punished him for that prediction. So you have those three elements, and what we're seeing right now is two of the three. We're
mm-hmm.
seeing the base of the time frame, which the TOR code researchers have established, and that goes back to 1998 with Drazen. So this is something that's been there for quite some time, and the Bible code, what we can now call TOR code, is proven in terms of its predictive powers. It is a scientific method. We have sensitives that are also beginning to report this, and then the next thing is looking to see, you know, what are the animals going to do? How are they responding to it? And I thought you brought that point up eloquently. So right now what we have is something where...
Yeah, we got two of the three.
Situation. We got two of the three. This is, when you have two of the three, that's when you say, okay, it's time for situational awareness. It's not time to go run up and down the neighborhood screaming, oh my God, we're all going to die. No, that's not what you do. This is the time to just start being in awareness of the environment around you. And it's a time to prepare. This is the time to prepare while there's plenty of goods on the shelves and they're not, you know, there's no one's gouging you and you don't have to stand in a long line to get it.
Okay. Well, it's also time for us to take this call. Caller, your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin, and hi, Marshall. This is Victoria, and I'm calling from Washington State. I wanted to just maybe get your comment. I've been listening to the news. Gosh, it seems like the last 2, maybe 3 weeks at the most. There have been in Washington State and Oregon, and I even think California, there have been bears coming out of the woods in droves, appearing in the city streets and people's backyards and, you know, in the city, and also deer. And I'm thinking this is kind of an unusual behavior for them. And I was thinking, gee, I wonder if something's up, you know, in terms of... you know, something happening, because this is real unusual. I mean, every now and then you do have bears show up out of the woods, but not like they have been in the last couple of weeks. And I just thought, well, that's really strange, and they're wild, and, you know, it's not dogs and cats. But I was wondering if maybe you could look into that or pay attention to that and see if there's anything, you know, happening more extensively. And I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Well, I don't know that that's the animal connection that I was looking for, but what do you think?
I think Victoria really asked a fabulous question. You know, when I was talking with Birkeland about, at the time we were concerned with Yellowstone had just gone to red flag, so it's in a red status right now. And one of the questions I asked him is, what to you would be a clear harbinger sign if I'm a tourist up there that I need to get the heck out of the park, get out of the state, get as far away from there as I can? He said, when the buffalo start to run like crazy, you run.
You know, I got to tell you something. Now, this is not exactly the same thing. But when I first started international policing, I was in Bosnia.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Brčko, up in northern Bosnia, in the area that's called Republika Srpska. Okay, so I'd get off work, you know, and I want to go over to the pizza place and get me some pizza. There was always a taxi. All up and down the street, you just hail a taxi and they take you where you want to go. And you finish there and you want to go, there was a bar across town that had electronic darts. Well, you know, there wasn't a heck of a lot to do in Birch Co. So there were no movies, you couldn't go bowling, there were no ball games, you know. So electronic darts was a big activity. Hey, walk outside of the pizza place, hail a taxi, and go. And one night, there were no taxis. None. No taxis.
Wow.
And I thought, well, it's not that far to the pizza place, I'll walk. So I walked. And I thought, when I left there, I thought, well, I'll go play darts. But it was a long ways to that place. And there were no taxis. None. So I walked back home. At 2:40 in the morning, a riot started. And that riot rocked until midnight the next night. And, I mean, it was a quite serious riot. August the 28th. 1997, and I learned from that. I taught all the incoming international police, if you ever walk out on the street and the taxis are gone, take cover. And you know, I've been to 14 of these missions in war zones. And that has always been infallible. If the taxis disappear, because they own their own taxi, you see. They own their own car. They don't want it torn up, and they know what's coming. So when they disappear, it's time to take cover. And the same sort of thing is what the natives do, native peoples, all around the world. When the animals head for the hills, so do they.
That's it. And they're running for the hills screaming, feet don't fail me now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people that in Sumatra, the ones that did all the dying, frankly, were the people with the cars, the money, and the educations.
Oh, well, that's right.
I mean, they had the material goods. It was the folks that we make fun of, the so-called ignorant natives, that had enough common sense to be in a state of awareness and in tune with the environment around them. Now, when they saw that these animals were going, get out of Dodge, you know, their mm-hmm. training, they understood. And I think, this story that you told about with the taxis, this is really spot on. This is really spot on. All I'm trying to tell people to do is, hey, be as up to speed as a Bosnian taxi driver.
Well, I've been in a lot of different countries, and they were what we would call war zones, and the wars all happen for various reasons. None of these are identical. The only thing identical is if the taxis disappear, you do it too.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
All right, let me give the telephone number out real quickly. 623-444-5889 is the number to call if you wish to talk with one of our guests. Or you can, if you're in the USA or Canada, you can call us toll-free at 888-223-4599. We have a flash message from Leonardo in Puerto Rico. Hi, Kevin. Interesting show tonight. A couple of weeks back, we had a 5.8 in Puerto Rico. It was strong. It was at 1:16 a.m. I woke up with the noise that sounded like a growling sound. I immediately woke my wife, and the house started rocking strong. By the time we got to the door to go outside, it stopped. With little aftershocks. We got out of the house and found that our neighbors were outside too. They were freaked out, just like us. The thing I found weird was that the neighborhood dogs were mute. Not a sound of them. Well, what does your guest think? My son, who lives in the city of Moca, where the quake sprang from, said that he thought a, I'm not sure what this is, Galaxy C5 was flying over his house. It was shocking. So what do you think about that?
Well, first thing I'm thinking is I'd like his attention to detail. And he noticed that the dogs weren't barking. Now, I could only speculate on that. And I would have to wonder if there's something that is germane to that area. You know, when you travel around the world, pets are different, and to a certain extent. But again, it comes back to being in awareness. He was, you know, immediately when things were happening, he's sensing it. He has excellent recall. I think this is really important for everyone out there to understand that the most important thing is you just have to be really aware of what's happening. You might get just a few seconds notice. And it's the difference between standing there going, huh, what's that? And next thing you know, of, you know, the building's falling on you, or maybe you're sensitive enough to what's happening in your local area that, you know, you don't ask anybody, and you don't even think about it.
All right, we have to step away for a break, and we'll return, folks, right after this. Okay, we are on final approach, and that means I've got time for one, maybe two, if you hurry, calls at 623-444-5889, toll free at 888-223-4599, or you may send me a flash message if you are outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada. We're talking with Marshall Masters and Richard Shaw. I got a question for Richard here. You still with us, Richard?
I'm still here.
Okay, Richard, when you look at this, at the Torah code, you know, you mentioned this earlier, that it says threat, or this is a threat, or something about a threat.
Right.
Okay. So it says earthquake 2010, what, Los Angeles or California or what?
Well, one of them, one of the tables says L.A., California, and the other one just says California.
Okay. And so 2010, and then what does it say about the threats? Tell us exactly the words about the threat.
It just basically in Hebrew says this is a threat in one table, and in the other table it just says a threat. So it's the same phrase doesn't appear in both tables, but the word threat does. And one thing that I was hoping to be able to interject quickly here, I'll go as quickly as I can, but I know that Professor Rift doesn't like to make predictions in the Torah. Occasionally, they just happen. They just kind of come out, and that's the way it works. And there's been a number of times where the predictions were correct. But the reason he doesn't like to do it is because we're putting in words to look for something, but we don't have enough information about the future to really know what to ask. So what happens sometimes is we put the words in there, we get an answer, but key words that should have been in the table aren't there just because we didn't know what to say. And this happened to Michael Drossin when he was trying to find out back during the 2000 election if Al Gore would be president, and the Torah code said yes, but then afterwards, after he didn't, they thought, well, what happened? Why didn't that prediction work? And next to the Hebrew text, I was sitting with Professor Rift in New York, and he shows me this. It said, he thinks maybe. So I just thought that was pretty funny, and you wouldn't know to search for the phrase "he thinks maybe" next to the words "Al Gore president." That would never dawn on anybody, but that's what actually was in the code. So essentially, the code was predictive, but we got the wrong inflection in it.
Okay, so the accuracy of it really depends upon the specificity of the information you ask it for.
That's right. So the reason a lot of the tables have not come to pass is because of our own inability to predict the future or know what to ask about the future.
Okay. Now back to the information about the threat. You know, I said earlier that could it be that someone with the technology to create earthquakes will threaten to do that? But there's another way to look at this too. And that is that when it says it's a threat, I think it could be interpreted as it's a high potential. There's a high potential for this, or a high possibility that it could happen. So if we look at it in that respect, you know the kids' game that it's an eight ball and you ask it a question, you shake it up, and then you turn it over and the answer floats up and you can see it? How?
It says maybe, or it says yes.
Yeah. How more accurate or less accurate would the eight ball be in this case?
Oh, well, I think that since that we can quantify our results on a computer, I think that we have a greater accuracy with the Torah codes than we would with an eight ball. Otherwise, there'd be no validity to be interested in the subject at all.
Mm-hmm.
And like Marshall was saying about technology, what they're doing is when they do these tests, they're running them on a cluster computer, and basically the speed of that means that you could look through 100,000 other text to see if the probability comes up on a table using the protocols used. And so what that would mean to a normal person is that on a normal PC, it would take 300 days to do what it takes them to do in 8 days.
Okay. Now,
I think use is also something here needs to be, let's a little bit of honesty here.
Well, hang on just a second. We'll get into that.
Okay.
Because you know I never ask a question unless I have a destination already picked out.
Oh, yeah.
If we can statistically show that the Torah code is statistically more accurate than the use of this eight-ball kids game, and the question I asked about the eight ball was predicated upon the interpretation of threat as a high potential or high possibility, I think you can see that if you say it's a possibility, I can also tell you, you know, that polka dot elephants are a possibility. Well, they are a possibility. But when we look at statistical accuracy, that would, and you take your answer that you just gave us about the statistical accuracy over the eight ball, I think we can say that this interpretation of it being a high potential, a high possibility, would not be the correct interpretation. There would be no reason for it to say, well, you know, it may rain martinis. You follow what I'm saying? There would be no statistical accuracy in saying it may rain martinis. The eight ball could do that, but if there's statistical accuracy in this Torah code, it would not be saying things like that. Therefore, it seems to point to an actual threat of an earthquake as opposed to a potential or a probability of an earthquake. Or am I all wet?
I think that's a fair assessment. And one of the things...
I do too. I mean, I don't know how to interpret that phrase, whether that means that it's happening or not. I think that what interests me about the table to begin with was that the table that had big earthquake in it, 1994, that indeed occurred. So the fact that we have the same table also saying in 5770, which is 2010, caught my attention. I thought, well, the first half of that table has already come to pass, and if it's true for the first half, maybe it's true for the second half.
Well, I don't know. I as I said, I may be all wet. However, I'm just crawling out there on a speculative limb, and I'm saying that if there's statistical accuracy to the table, I can't see it telling us 2010 it may rain martinis. I mean, you know, that's something I can do. That's something the eight ball can do. And there doesn't have to be any statistical accuracy, because everyone can say, well, yeah, anything's possible. But if it's actually giving accurate information and there's statistical accuracy in its predictions, then when it says this is a threat, I don't think it's saying it's a possibility. But again, maybe I'm wrong.
Well, he's saying that, but you know, you're using the eight ball analogy, and I remember that eight ball. I had one when I was in college.
You're going to have to remember fast, because the end of the show is just taken over. Guys, stay on the line with me. All right, folks, we ran out of time. I wish we had more time, but we don't. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.